Mr. Mason, ring three.
We were chased around a bit, the usual sort of commando training, cross-country runs and that sort of thing. But we were all pretty fit young men in those days, and that didn't seem to worry us. A few fell by the wayside, but that was par for the course, I suppose. And then the rest of the party were sent to the parachute training area, which was at Ramat David. And there we trained for our parachute jumps, perhaps 2 days preliminary training, ground training as they called it. And then we formed into two sticks. I think there was something like 20 of us left, officers and mainly NCOs. And we did our prescribed 4 day jumps and 1 night jump. And at the end of that period, we were presented with our wings and told that we should get an extra 2 shillings a day. And later I discovered that that meant I was put into the income tax class. So they deducted 8 pence a day for my income tax. But I only discovered that later. So then it was back to Carmel, where they produced the new radio set, new to me, and I did just a very short spell on learning how to operate it and so on and so forth. And then not all of us, but a number of us went straight back to Cairo, to Rustam Buildings in the first instance, and then I was put into a flat in the Main Street, Rue Solomon Pasha, I think it was, a flat high up. And there we stayed, and I was told, I'd been told at Rustam that I would be going into Greece at the first opportunity, because I had to replace a wireless operator who they thought had been captured by the Germans, and I was to replace him.
How did you feel about that?
Oh, quite happy. Quite happy to be actually doing a job. The wireless operator, I believe, was with a man called Major Shepherd, Rufus Shepherd. I don't know if that rings a bell. And he was in the Mount Olympus area. Anyway, the operator disappeared. They believed he'd been caught by the Germans. So, from Cairo, I was kitted out in Cairo, of course, and with 6 other people, there was an RAF party who were being dropped into Greece, and their job was to reconnoitre up through Greece and Yugoslavia to find suitable places to build airstrips. So there was a party of 6, and the wireless operator who I had met in training, a Sergeant Dutton, he was with them, and 5 RAF, I think, officers, I'm not sure. And so off we went to Derna in a Dakota, and Derna was, of course, the hopping-off place across to, at that time, to Yugoslavia and Greece, Albania and so on. And after a day or two at Derna, the weather supposedly being right, we boarded the Halifax, and off we went to drop into Greece. But although the Mediterranean was clear as we flew across, it was thick cloud all over Greece that night, and we just couldn't pick up the ground, couldn't pick up anything at all. We were looking for fires, the usual formation of fires and the recognition signal of the day, but we could see nothing. So we flew around for 30 minutes or so, no breaks in the crowd, and then headed straight back to Derna. And so back we went and landed, oh, I don't know, just as it was dawn, I suppose. And there we had to stay for another 5 days, I suppose, until we got the signal to take off again. And then off we went, same party, same aircraft, same pilot. And this time the ground was quite clear, perfectly clear. You could see the mountains and the snow and the fires of the shepherds. And then it was the pilot's job to pick out a particular group of fires and to look for the signal of the day, the letters that would be sent by Aldous Lamp. I did quite a lot of that later. And then he would pick his spot and out the seven of us, found it all right, and out the seven of us jumped.
When was this?
That was the beginning of October 43. There was a party on the ground, of course, a reception party at the DZ. Two captains, Widlaw and Wicksted, and they were in charge of the mission at a little village, I think, called Rittini, about a 3-hour march down the mountain.
How do you spell Rittini?
R-I-T-I-N-I. This is in the Piera mountain area. Piera, P-E-I-R-A, is it? Piera mountain area. The nearest large town would be Catarini on the coast. That would possibly be the nearest town. Well, I arrived that evening, got to this village that evening, and the following evening I set up my wireless set, a brand new B2 and battery, and sent off, you know, for my first contact with Cairo, and to my surprise got through straight away. Unfortunately, right in the middle of sending an acknowledgement, the set went dead on me. And so I never finished the message, what I was trying to say. And
what was the problem?
Well, that I didn't discover till, the next day, virtually. I found it was a part in the B2 set, the power set, power side of it, which was a vibratory unit. And I should have had a spare, but when I looked for the spare, which I'd been told was in the case, it had been taken out. Someone else had nobbled it for another set, probably. This is the usual story. However, I did manage to take out the vibratory unit, which I assumed had gone wrong. And I managed to take the base off it and found that I suppose in the dropping that it had a bit of a bump, and the actual vibratory side of it wasn't working. But with a little bit of manoeuvring, I managed to get it going again, put it back, and the set worked fine, you know. In the meantime, a message had come through on the other set to Rittini, to say that the wireless operator who had been captured, and he had been captured, and escaped, had escaped, and was now back with his mission. And so there was no need for me to go over there, you see. They didn't want me at all. So I was a spare wireless operator with my set. So I was told not to open up again until I was given further instructions through the Rittini set of the mission. So I simply packed up my suitcase and hid it away, tucked it away with charging engine, batteries, that sort of thing, and all my gear. then a party came into the village under this Major Scott I mentioned, Ken Scott. And it was the time that an order had gone out that SOE should create as much trouble for the Germans as they possibly could by blowing bridges and trains whenever and wherever they could. And since I was spare at that time, I asked Major Scott if I could join his party and go on, you know, a couple of exercises. So we did, so off we went, and we, I think we mainly in the first instance did some recce work along the railway line, made one or two attempts to approach a couple of bridges. They were always manned, of course, guarded by the Germans. And then one night, a week or so later, we did go down and made up our charges and went down with Winlaw and Wickstead. I'd got an idea Major Scott wasn't there that evening, and we did actually blow up our first train. We tried, you see, we used to put the charges under the line and use a sort of fog signal to explode the charges. But our first few attempts were unsuccessful. Whether we had dud charges or not, I don't know, fog signals. But finally, that night, we did get a train which wasn't very valuable, really, an empty goods train, I think it was. So that wasn't considered to be, you know, much of an adventure, really. We did several attempts at trains. Of course, we were helped by the guerrillas. The Andartes were supposed to help us, but they didn't seem to be too enthusiastic. The trouble was that when you blew a train or caused a lot of damage in this particular area, the Germans, you could get away all right, but the Germans would come up to that area and descend on the nearest village, and if they caught anybody there, they'd just shoot them and burn the houses down, you see, as reparation. But, you know, this thing had to be done, and that was that. Most of the Greeks got very wise to this and disappeared up into the mountains when this happened. So I don't think the Germans caught very many of them. I think in the towns they took hostages, certainly in Greece and all those occupied countries, they took hostages, and a number of them were shot after one of these incidents. On Christmas Eve, we went down to the line to blow the rather famous train which left Athens, I think, on a Friday evening, a German troop train which went back to Berlin for leave, the weekly leave train. And this, of course, was an important one, going back for Christmas. And we went down to the line, quite a party of us, with explosives, and laid them on the line. It was quite a complicated thing because we had to cooperate with the Greek signalman from the nearest signal box, who'd send us a message when the train was on its way. We knew roughly the time it would come through our particular area. So we got the charges laid, but the exploders weren't then on the line, so we were sort of lying on the embankment waiting for the signal to put this, to put the exploders on the line. We hadn't heard this one before, but what had happened was that the Germans, of course, had got wise to this business of blowing trains, and when we got the signal to say that the train was coming, we dashed up onto the line and put the fog signals, which were already connected, onto the track. And then there was a great hullabaloo and a shout to take them off again, because it was a pilot train, and that was an engine pushing three flat trucks ahead of the troop train. So if we'd got those exploders on the line, all that would have happened would have, we'd have blown up the decoy train, and there would have been time for the troop train to pull up, you see. So of course we knew nothing of this, but we did manage to get the exploders off the line. And just as we did this, and I was still on the embankment, the troop train appeared, and it couldn't have been more or less than a mile, mile behind the pilot train. And so we just frozen on the embankment. I was under a small bush. The train came past, it seemed to be going at quite a rate, and then all of a sudden jammed on its brakes and sparks came out of the wheel. And it stopped, slowed down and stopped. And the back of the train, when I looked up, I could see the rear, right at the end of the train, there was a sort of platform, and on the platform looked to be a couple of guards with a machine gun, and goodness knows what. They were up there talking and smoking. Everything was quiet, and I was just lying below them. Of course, I could hardly breathe, you know, and thinking that they're going to see me, and which way shall I run? But we stayed there, I don't know how long it was, it must have been, we thought it was about 10 minutes. And then gradually there were a couple of toots in the distance. And thankfully the train just moved off, you know, nobody got down onto the tracks or anything like that. It just moved away. All it was, we discovered afterwards, that the Germans knew nothing, they had no suspicions really whether they were there, but the railway line in Greece is just a single line from north to south with just a few passing loop lines and signal boxes. This is where we got a lot of the information about train movements. And the slower trains used to pull in on the loop lines at these little boxes, control boxed loop lines, for the faster trains to come through. I suppose something had gone wrong, and on this occasion the troop train had to stop. So we didn't get that troop train at all. So we stayed there and attempted another train, put the fog signals back, and they failed to explode. And finally, it was Major Scott who attached a piece of what they called safety fuse to the explosive charges and waited until we heard a train approaching. And at the very last minute, he lit the fuse and ran, you see. And of course, what happened was the engine driver must have seen the sparks from the safety fuse and he put on his brakes, but he was a bit too late because the explosives went off just under his engine, which derailed it and tipped it over onto the embankment, you see. Well, then all the guerrillas who were there supposedly helping us opened fire on the train. There was no response from anybody on the train, so it was quite empty. It was goods, mixed goods, and I think there were a couple of tankers on there. It might have been empty. But I could see no sign of Major Scott, you see, so I walked down to the place where I'd last seen him and called his name quietly, but now no sign of him. I thought perhaps he'd been shot by these guerrillas opening up as soon as the train stopped, because he hadn't got much time to get away. Well, anyway, I walked back up the length of the train, still looking around, and as I got to the end of the train, a machine gun opened up on me, much to my surprise, and we had these little fireflies whistling around me, you see. And I dropped to the ground and waited for a bit, and then the fire moved away. I don't think they saw me. They might have heard me struggling around or stumbling around. And finally I crawled away and started back quite on my own the way we'd come down. And after about half an hour of struggling through the brushwood there, I was confronted by a figure with a pistol pointing at my head, and it was actually Major Scott. He'd heard me coming up and thought I was somebody after him, you see. Anyway, we joined forces, and we were all pretty tired at that moment, and but we knew that the Germans would soon be seething around this particular area. So we struggled on up the mountainside until we joined up with the rest of the party.
What was this place where the train was attacked?
Litochrane, quite a well-known village in the foothills of Mount Olympus.
How do you spell it?
L-I-T-C-H-O-C-O-R-O-N, Litochrane. That seemed to be our favourite place around there, Litochrane. And Litochrane was a place where, of course, the Germans used to come up, and every time they came, there was quite a good road up to Litochrane. The local Greeks took to the hills as fast as they could until things had quietened down, and they used to move back again. Well, then we heard, when we reached this party, the rest of the party, that Rutini, in our absence, had been overrun. Most of the inhabitants had got away, but they found a lot of our gear, and presumably my wireless set charging engine and everything like that. Everything went, my spare kit that I'd come in with, it all went. And we never went back to Rutini at all. Half the village was burnt down. So it was decided we should head for a safer area because the Germans were around and they were chasing us up and they were looking for us.
Which part of Greece is Rutini in terms of north, south, east, west?
It's north. The nearest place, I suppose, to any of those areas would be Salonika. So it would be north-central Greece. Yes, pretty north-central. Perhaps more to the east, perhaps, than central.
So you decided to move from there to which area?
Well, we had to. We had to move from there then across the road, across the mountains, across the main road, to the Descarti area, which was perhaps, a 50, 60 mile march. And Descarti was quite a big town, largest town in the mountains. There were a lot of, Elam guerrillas in that area. Their headquarters were there at one period. And there I became fairly ill because I developed yellow jaundice, of all things. And I had to stay in the village, and I was looked after very well by the villagers for about a week. And there I was visited by Colonel Hammond, who was very kind and brought me one or two gifts, things to eat and so on. But I gradually got better. I felt a bit off colour for several weeks after that. And then I think it was probably Colonel Hammond who said that when I was better, I would move to a place called Mavreli, not far across the mountain, to a mission there, which the OC was Major Jim Scott. Quite a well-known character, MC, ex-regular soldier, warrant officer, I think. He was in charge of the mission there with Major McCool and Dr. Felton. He was the medical officer. A number of Greek interpreters. A Greek wireless operator called Tasso. And there I stayed, and after I'd, you know, sort of recovered from my jaundice and so on and so forth, malnutrition as well, I think, there was a bit more food over there than we'd had before, I took over the main operating of the station. And there we worked back to Cairo and then eventually to Foggia, Italy, or near Foggia. And I stayed there until, until the liberation in early December 44, when the Germans, of course, packed in and left, back up the roads to Yugoslavia. And it was there near Mavreli, between Mavreli and Descati, that a squadron leader, Hudson, came in and actually constructed an airstrip between those two, in the valley between those two villages, 2,000 yard airstrip, where later we received Dakotas flying in from Italy. And on one occasion we had a flight of South African piloted Mustang fighter aircraft who came over from Italy to strafe the retreating Germans and the tanks up the roads leading to Yugoslavia, and then landed at the airstrip and refueled from drums of petrol that had been brought over by the Dakotas. And then refueled and flew back to Italy. And they did this on a number of occasions, without any interference from the Germans at all.
How keen were the Greeks to stop the retreating Germans?
Not very. Because, they'd had enough of the Greeks and the Italians, and the idea was, I suppose, for them to be attacked on all sides. To stop them leaving, but of course most Greeks, and I must say I agreed with them, wanted to see the back of them. And the less damage they did in their retreat or withdrawal, the better. And the other point was that the guerrillas, especially Ayam and Elassu, hoped to control the country after the war, wanted to hold on to their arms and ammunition as much as they could, the explosives and everything else that had been dropped into them, so that they could carry on the battle with the other royalists, Edes, and all the other factions that were around at the time. No, they were not keen on stopping or interfering with the Germans leaving at all.
How much personal contact did you have with the political problems in Greece at the time?
Personally, not a lot. I wasn't a political person at all. I sympathised with the lot of the villagers, and it must have been horrific up there before the war. I mean, even their peacetime living must have been pretty awful, because you see, it's such a barren country. They scratched a living from patches in the mountains to grow their maize, their corn, to make their bread. Kept a cow or two, a few sheep, a lot of goats up in the mountain ranges amongst the trees. The goats, of course, devoured everything in sight. But it was